I think one of the coolest things that we can experience or be confronted with is, in fact, what Lane just said, their heart transformation. Perhaps you've known someone who they're just vastly different than maybe how you had first met them, because the Lord had done something in their heart, and they're changed, and they're different from the inside out. And that's what when we look at the scriptures, when we look at the word and what God has for us, that's really the epitome of what he's doing and what he's about, is that he's doing a work. And most of the work, you know, we oftentimes look, Lord, do this, you know, give me a good parking spot, et cetera, et cetera. And sometimes we nail a good parking spot and say, wow, God is so good. But the reality of it is he cares a lot more about what's going on the inside as to whether we get a good parking spot or not. And I love that beautiful picture of heart transformation. Because that's really, that's the nuts and bolts of Christianity. Because that's where God does something on the inside. And we've talked about that over and over and over again. And that's actually not where we're going today necessarily, except for the fact that even in the midst of all these scriptures, we're talking about Daniel. And sometimes we look at the book of Daniel and we look at, wow, that's so good. It's so great. It's history and it's so neat how God worked. And we fail to maybe see that heart transformation piece or maybe what it has to do with us. But I want us to grasp a few things this morning as we get into Daniel. Because what we're doing today is we're looking at Daniel chapter 11. And this is where Daniel gets to be a little bit more difficult. Okay, Daniel 11 and 12. In order for us to understand Daniel 11 and 12, I think what we're going, and this is what we're going to do today, we need to step back and look at this book of Daniel kind of and the flow of Daniel as a whole. And so we're going to do a little bit of review today. We will not finish with Daniel chapter 11 today. We're going to get to a certain point and we're going to stop. We're going to continue that on next week. But what we find in Daniel chapter 11, and it partners well with what we talked about last week, if you were here last week, Daniel chapter 10, 11, and 12, they kind of are all part of that same encapsulating vision that Daniel has that points towards the end. There's been a lot of controversy and disagreement in dealing with Daniel chapter 11. And we're not going to pretend like that doesn't exist. In that same capacity, we're not going to present things in such dogma as if I somehow now have come to the enlightened fact that many scholars have yet been able to, you know, conclude, and now I'm the one with all the right answers. I don't believe that that's the case. However, there's strong evidence to point to what it is that I feel and where this is going. And so what we're actually going to see in Daniel chapter 11 is this flow coming into such great detail. One of the reasons that Daniel chapter 11 has been so criticized is because it is filled with so much detail. Many scholars even look at Daniel chapter 11 and say, there's no way that that can be true. There's no way that that can be prophetic because it was in such detail and all of those prophecies came true. You follow what I'm saying there? Basically, people are criticizing the book of Daniel saying that it can't be true because it's too accurate. It's really, in a sense, what they're saying. Because what Daniel does in chapter 11 is he lays out so much detail, a lot of what we've already talked about. That's why we're going to start back and kind of pull it in and review a little bit. Come in with so much detail that all of those things to be fulfilled the way that they were, that's impossible. And in human standards, they're right. But the difference of it is we're talking about a God who has laid this out for Daniel over and over and over again. And now we get to this point and gives them these pictures. And I have some theories and beliefs, and I believe, excuse me, as to why God gives these details. But it's really quite astounding. So let's not miss the fact of God's great detail. How God does exactly what he says he's going to do. So see that. See what God's going to do. And then what I want us to be able to get to the point of today is seeing all that God has done and seeing all that detail, and God brings about all that stuff to be true. I want us to understand that when this occurs and when this happens, we also have prophecies that are yet to come. And when we have those prophecies yet to come, because of all he's done in the past, we can be assured God's going to continue to do that which he has set out to do. So here's a little bit of Daniel. If you're new with us, you're in luck today because we are going to take a look at all of that which we have looked at and talked about leading up to this point. So in Daniel. So here's how it starts. I've got a number of PowerPoints. Honestly, these might be all mixed up because I kept flipping things around. I didn't know what the order was. This is how my brain works. Some people are very linear, sequential. This might just step you into this. How does he function this way? And that's okay. Okay. So here's how we start. Looking at Daniel. Daniel was in Jerusalem at the time. Here's Jerusalem. The kingdom of Israel had already been divided. All right. There had been the northern 10 tribes had basically, they had fallen to idolatry, and the Assyrians, who were been up in this area here, had come in and conquered Israel a number of years before the Babylonians are going to come into Judea. All right. Again, that's just history stuff. Some people really love history. Some people are already falling asleep. I'm sorry. You know, in the future, just bring coffee with you. And so you can get to that history part. Just keep, you know, jacking yourself up with some caffeine. Okay. So the Assyrians had already conquered here. And here you have Judah, and they stayed true at least a little bit longer, but not a lot longer. And what ended up happening is they also fell into idolatry. And God said, enough of this. And so what ended up happening then is God had prophesied that this would happen. He had prophesied it through the prophet Isaiah and part of Daniel or part of Jeremiah. But what ended up happening then is we had the Babylonians, who had an empire. I'll show you that in a moment. They came in, they conquered Jerusalem and Judah, and they began to take exiles back into Babylon. I know for a lot of you, this is review. For some of you, maybe you're just visiting, this is your first time, or you didn't start at the beginning. This is like, oh, also, this is what he's been talking about the last couple of weeks. And so this shows then the kingdom of Babylon, the empire of Babylon, pretty good sized empire, really. When you look at this is what Jerusalem or Israel was, here's the divided, here's the north, south, and Judea would have been down here. So here comes Nebuchadnezzar in roughly 605 BC, conquers Jerusalem, and then begins to take all of these Jews back to Babylon and exiles them. We talked about some of the political and militaristic point of this. He basically brought all of these Jews back to conform them, to assimilate them into the Babylonian culture. He wanted them to become Babylonians. He wanted them to kind of set aside all of their Jewish history, all of their Jewish beliefs, and become totally Babylonian. And he did this by doing several things. One is we found in Daniel chapter 1. That's how we started. In Daniel chapter 1, it talked about how they came over and they were given these choice foods to eat. Remember? And Daniel, along with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, these great, wise, smart guys that had been hauled off into exile, said, no, we want to just stick with fruits and vegetables. We know that it's better for us. You know, meat is bad. We don't want anything that these choice foods. They wanted to, in a sense, separate themselves and not be assimilated into the Babylonian culture. The Babylonians said, eat all this good food, and we're going to find that you're going to say, ooh, this is a great place to be. We're all in. And Daniel and these guys had enough sense to say, you know, we kind of get what you're doing. We want to keep our distance. And that, in a sense, then was Daniel chapter 1. They're taken into exile, and that was what we covered. Daniel chapter 2, then, what we find is Daniel had risen into some prominency in regards to who he was, and he was well known. And what ended up happening is Nebuchadnezzar had this bad dream. Remember the bad dream? Bad dream was his statue. It terrified him. We don't know if he even remembered the dream, but we got to the point where Nebuchadnezzar goes to all of his wise men, his magicians, and he says, here's the deal. I had a bad dream last night. I want you to tell me what my dream was and then interpret the dream. And all these guys saying, you've lost your mind. You can't do that. And he says, you want to bet? In fact, you either do what I say or I will kill you all. And so the edict goes out. And he says, basically, go kill all the wise men because they couldn't do what I asked them to do. They get to Daniel's house. Daniel, here, we're going to take you in. We're going to kill you. And Daniel says, wait, don't kill me yet. And he says, give me, in a sense, 24 hours. And I'm going to pray and see if God will, in fact, deliver not only me and my people, but also all these other magicians. And so they said, okay, fine, we'll give you 24 hours. Daniel goes to his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He says, pray with me that the Lord will reveal this to us. Because here's the deal. If he doesn't, we're all dead. And so they pray with Daniel, and sure enough, God gives Daniel the vision. He goes back to the king and says, guess what? And the king says, have you, you know, been able to tell me the dream? And Daniel says, I cannot. You ask the impossible. But there's a God who can. That's the whole message we see over and over again, isn't it? In the book of Daniel, the God who can. And when the criticisms come in Daniel chapter 11, that's impossible. That's the point. It is impossible. But with God, you can. Isn't that something? And I don't want us to leave this morning without recognizing that with God, we can, even in the impossible. That's pretty sweet. So here it is. Daniel says, I can't do it, but God can. And guess what? God, and he does that. And he tells him that the statue, the head of gold, the torso of silver, the hips of bronze, and the legs of iron. And then I just love it. Then this stone carved out of the mountain comes out. These pictures of Jesus come over and over again through the gospel of or the book of Daniel. Call it the gospel. It could just as well be. Comes through the book of Daniel, this stone cut out of the mountainside and crushes the statue. And so Nebuchadnezzar, oh, great, Daniel, you're wonderful. We get into Daniel, where am I at here? There we go. Daniel chapter 3. What we find is Daniel's kind of out of the picture, but he knows what has happened. He may have been off on some king's errand, if you will, but we find Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Here now, Nebuchadnezzar has had the idea, oh, that was a great vision we had. I am going to make myself a big gold statue. That was pretty cool. I like that picture. So he makes himself a big gold statue, maybe of himself, maybe of the god Nabu. It doesn't really make much difference. Either way, it was an idol that he called everyone to worship. When you hear the music, bow down and worship this idol. Well, you had three guys, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They set themselves apart and were not going to be assimilated into the Babylonian culture. They set themselves apart and said, I don't think so. And so when the music played, they didn't bow. And the Nebuchadnezzar's ruler said, hey, guess what? There's these three guys, they won't bow. And Nebuchadnezzar said, hey, guess what? You guys get to thrown into the fiery furnace if you will not. But I'll give you one more chance. And they said, nope, sorry, king. Our king or our God has the power to save us. Our God can, but even if he doesn't, we will never bow down and worship your statue. So they get thrown in the fiery furnace, and while they're in there, they see one guy that's all shiny and bright, and they recognize that one of the gods was in there. We don't know. Was it an angel? Was it Jesus Christ? It's interesting. We see this potential. Again, we don't know all the details. Image of Jesus Christ coming in through the book of Daniel over and over again. And I think that's pretty astounding. Chapter 4 then, Nebuchadnezzar has another dream. This is the dream of a tree. Remember, there's a great, big, beautiful tree. It's shading the whole ground, providing fruit for everyone. It's magnificent. But then the tree basically withers and dries up and is cut down and it falls. And Daniel says, hey, sorry, buddy. This is kind of a bummer dream for you. This basically means you're going to lose your kingdom. And Nebuchadnezzar's like, wow, that's really downer. But he goes and changes nothing. In fact, what we find then is he's up on his vast walls in Babylon that are like 35 feet wide. It's said that you can take a four-horse chariot and do a U-turn on these magnificent walls of Babylon. And as he's there, perhaps looking over his hanging gardens, which was one of the wonders of the world at that time, and it says, the Bible says that as he was speaking the words, look at all that I have done. Look at what my hands have created. Look at my power. This basically is, Hubris. Hubris. It's this arrogance. It's not only arrogance, but it's this overriding self-confidence. You know, it's a unique word, beyond arrogant, beyond prideful. It's like this all-encompassing picture of I am magnificent. And when we find that throughout the book of Daniel, they will be cut down over and over again. Next week, we're going to see that happen even more, and we're going to get right up to that point for next week, and we're going to shut her down. So Nebuchadnezzar has this dream of the tree, and he says, just as he was speaking the words, God cut him down. He loses his kingdom for a number of years. We don't know how long that was. Some people believe it was 7 years. The time doesn't really make a difference. He was cast out for a time until he turned his eyes and his face back to God. And when he turned his face back to God, his sanity was restored, and so was his kingdom. Shortly after that, then, he does die a natural death. And then what we find is one of the next kings to come, Belshazzar, also has this arrogance and this pridefulness. But this one isn't necessarily curable. And so in this guy, he's throwing this party. He takes and flaunts God by taking all of these sacred things that have been taken from the temple, these sacred goblets and such, and he throws a wild party with his friends. They pour alcohol into these sacred goblets, and they begin to drink and get themselves drunk using these sacred elements. And as they're doing that, a hand appears and writes on the wall. And basically it says, numbered, numbered, counted, and basically cut down. It's going to be removed from you. And he doesn't understand what it means. And so he calls again. Daniel's the guy. And he says, guess what, Belshazzar? You're going to lose your kingdom. Your transgressions are counted. They are numbered against you, and you will be cut down. And before that night was even over, that's when we saw the Persians come in and conquered Babylon, and that was the end of the Babylonian Empire. And then what we find is right early on, again, these first six chapters of Daniel are all historic in nature. There's elements of prophecy in there, absolutely, but these are kind of historic in nature, and then they change for the next ones. This is where we find King Darius, and when Darius is king, again, some of these people recognize Daniel. Man, this guy is, he's just like, he's that leader that we don't like because he has got such great character. And I know that doesn't make sense, but when you're the underling and you look at this guy, it's like, man, if we could just get him out of the way, then we could rise to that position of power. Again, you see this arrogance and pride of the people. So they set up this plan that says, basically, you know, Darius, make this edict that says, only worship you, only pray to you for like 30 days. That'll be plenty of time because Daniel prays continually and he prays to only his God. And so they do that. And guess what? There's Daniel. He's caught red-handed, looking out the window towards Jerusalem, and as he's praying, so they throw him into a den of lions, and the Lord closes the mouths of the lions, and Daniel comes out unharmed, unscathed. That's remarkable. These are, again, all these stories that God can and that God does. And then what we found is it changed. At this point, it's less historical. Now Daniel's writing. He's writing about these visions that he's had. What I want us to grasp in these next few is just pay attention to how these are building and escalating to Daniel chapter 11. Each one gives a little bit more detail. In Daniel chapter 2, we had that first picture. You had the kingdom. You had the head of gold, the torso of silver, the hips of bronze, and the legs of iron. That was vague, right? We got a little bit of detail as what they meant, but it kind of stopped there. Now it's going to progress. We're going to get a little bit more detail. So in Daniel's dream of the four beasts, then we saw the lion and the bear and the leopard, and then the beast that's unnameable, still symbolizing all four of those kingdoms, but they give a little bit more detail. Because what did we find? We found that this kingdom of the leopard had four wings. Well, what did the four wings mean? And we found out that that basically meant that out of that kingdom, there was going to come four leaders. You know, and we're going to see that progress even more so. So there's more detail given. Do you see that? It's important to note that because it helps give that credibility to Daniel chapter 11 that we're talking about. And so he sees these four beasts, the fourth one being the Roman kingdom. And then during that kingdom of Rome, that's when the Messiah will come. And that was shown in Daniel chapter 7 as well. Still, you see that picture of Jesus coming. And then we saw the wonderful ram and the unigoat. Okay, this is where he has another vision. This one, he's standing on the shores and he sees these two beasts come up. One is this ram, and he sees this ram with two horns. One horn was bigger than the other. That was the Persian Empire. More detail. One of those kings, Persia, was greater than the Medes. All right, it made sense. And then what we found also, then there came this goat, one-horned goat coming, and he comes so quickly and so swiftly, he destroys the ram. And then his horn is broken, and that was Alexander the Great, that we start to see some of this stuff come into fruition. This is important to note because this chapter 11 points to a lot of the details of what we're going to talk about. And then what we found in that unigoat, there was another small horn that rose up, and that was Antiochus Epiphanes. He was called the Abomination of Desolation. And from this one, we find that what this Antiochus Epiphanes did, and we'll talk a little bit more about that yet this morning, was to desecrate the temple. He put up an idol of Zeus in the Holy of Holies, in the Lord's temple. He actually sacrificed a pig, an unclean animal. And then he began to take the priests of the Jews and actually force pork down their throats. And that was forbidden for them. I mean, just everything he did was like anything that he could do to oppose God and oppose God's people, he did it. It just was astounding, an ugly picture. And Daniel says he's troubled by it. And then what we found because of that trouble, Daniel is like, he's in prayer. He's like, he recognizes that this exile is almost over. And yet even in the midst of that, what he finds himself troubled with all that is yet to come. And then he's given this picture of the 77s. You know, 70 sets of 70. 70 sets of 7 years. And it's just astounding, remarkable. And what we see then is nearing that end in that 69th, you find the Messiah comes, and that Messiah comes and will change everything. And it's just, again, there's all this picture all these details that are coming up. And then last week we looked at, this is where it starts into the section that we're looking at now, the veil was lifted. This veil of the spiritual realm. And so basically what Daniel was given was this sight to see the spiritual battle that was going on. Daniel had all these questions. He's in prayers like, Lord, what's going on? What's going to be happening? He was in mourning because they're supposedly, the exile was over and they were supposed to be rebuilding the temple and they weren't getting anywhere with it. And what God does is he unveils the spiritual realm so Daniel can see angels and demons fighting. And in fact, well, the one angel that came to him, comes to him and was delayed for 21 days as he fought the demon that was in control of Persia, and we got to see that spiritual realm. And so then what we do is we get into here in Daniel chapter 11. I don't have a lot of PowerPoints, and so if you're going to want a Bible, you're going to need a Bible, I would encourage you, you know, slip up your hand. One of my ushers can bring you a Bible. We're going to read through it, and we're going to kind of talk through it as we go. There just would be too much to go here. But understanding a little bit of the historical context that we've already talked about, what we're going to see is an amazing detail, much more detail about what some of these things that are to come. But this is how he starts. Last week we saw it just concluded with the angel had just said to Daniel, Daniel, even when King Darius was the king, I stood next to him protecting him. I mean, just an incredible picture of the spiritual battle that rages on. So now then, he says, the angel says, I tell you the truth, three more kings will arise in Persia. If you've ever read Daniel chapter 11, it can be very confusing, okay? So I want to break it down, give you some pieces of the detail. We would overwhelm ourselves with all the detail. We can't do that. So I just want to point to all this detail and then give you why I think God gives us all this detail. So there's three more kings will arise in Persia, and then a fourth who will be far richer than all the others. When he has gained power by his wealth, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. Okay, so this is where it's interesting. So four more kings will rise up in Persia. The fourth one is King Xerxes. This is the same King Xerxes that married Queen Esther, if you know some of your Old Testament. Had his wife, Queen Vashti, killed because she wasn't a good dancer, in a nutshell, okay? And so he ends up marrying Queen Esther. And what we find, and this is all true, King Xerxes was extremely wealthy. And then in 480 BC, this king starts stirring up, trying to go to war with Greece, who would have been to the north. And so this is 480 BC, and this was a number of years. And so basically, he was the instigator that kind of created this animosity between Greece and the Persians that existed for many, many years, kind of back and forth. There's these conflicts, and it was Xerxes that initiated it. And here you see in Daniel chapter 11, verse 2, this was written before it happened. Daniel, the book of Daniel would have been written roughly, finished up even in the 530s BC. So here we are 50 years or more before some of these events began to happen. And this is what's being told to him. And he writes these things down in just the incredible detail. He says, when he has gained power by his wealth, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. And he did that. Then a mighty king will arise who will rule with great power. And so this big jump from verse 2 to verse 3 is about 100 years or so that these conflicts existed, and now you have Alexander the Great coming onto the scene. And it fits chronologically, it fits perfectly. And we look at, here's this mighty king, Alexander the Great, and I love the fact, and we see this several times in this passage, in this chapter, and some of the next. And make note of it, because we'll touch on it more next week, but he says, who will rule with great power and do as he pleases. What you find is you have these great kings that come to power with such arrogance, and they basically, I am the ruler, I am the king, I don't care what God wants, I will do whatever I want. And that's kind of the epitome of these evil rulers. You even find it, and we'll talk again more next week, in the lives of people like Adolf Hitler, you know, or Mussolini or Stalin, and some of those evil World War II leaders. You see it in other people, Mao Zedong, world leaders that are known for their vicious nature, and they will do as they please no matter what anyone else thinks or does. That's the picture. This is the same stuff that was happening in World War II and other times as it was happening then. World leaders popping up, same picture. They look the same. Again, that's more for next week. And so then what we find, so let's just look at this here, and then we're going to get into the scriptures as we see it here. So what you have is here you had the Babylonian Empire, and then you have the Persian Empire. The Persians come in, they conquer the Babylonian Empire. And then this is what it looks like. And it's important to kind of see this picture, and I'm going to keep this one up as we work through some of it, because this ends up being the Seleucids, basically. Okay, Mesopotamia. That was Antiochus's rule. Seleucus was one of Alexander the Great's generals, and that was the land that he inherited. And some of the language we're going to look at, again, we've talked about before, but it's in much more detail. And then this is Ptolemy. And down in here, that was, again, one of Alexander the Great's generals, and he got that area. So notice again, just recap, and then we're going to hit the scriptures. We're going to kind of read through and plow through them a little bit. But remember some of what we've talked about before. Alexander the Great, he died suddenly at a very young age. And he said, give my kingdom to the strongest. We don't know what he meant by that, whether one of his sons who was the strongest son, was it one of the generals who was the strongest general. Either way, it didn't go to his family. It went to four generals. And you're going to see that written in the scriptures today, hundreds of years before it took place. Okay? So Daniel, here we go. Daniel chapter 11, starting in verse 4. I'll stop occasionally to maybe highlight some things. So then the angel said, after he has appeared, this is Alexander the Great, his empire will be broken up and parceled out toward the four winds of heaven. It will not go to his descendants, nor will it have the power he exercised, because his great empire will be uprooted and given to others. This was written hundreds of years before it took place. And that's a very detailed picture of what happened with Alexander the Great. Okay? And then verse 5, the king of the south. Now, when we start seeing these words, it's going to go north and south and north and south and north and south a lot. The center focus point based on the north and south is basically the beautiful land. We're going to see that written in this capacity. It's Jerusalem. Okay? So everything, Jerusalem would be lying right about in there. Okay? So everything, when it refers to north and south, is based off of that being the center point, the compass point. Understood? So when it talks about north and south, that's what it's north and south of, is the beautiful land, the holy land, Jerusalem. All right. So the king of the south will become strong. That's Ptolemy. But one of his commanders will become even stronger than he, and will rule his own kingdom with great power. It's going to be confusing. I'll give you some detail, but trust me on some of the stuff as we go through. Okay? After some years, they will become allies. The daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north to make an alliance, but she will not retain her power, and he and his power will not last. In those days, she will be handed over together with her royal escort and to her father and to the one who supported her. History has shown that Ptolemy's daughter, I think it's Ptolemy II, his daughter Berenice was given as an alliance marriage to Antiochus III. So Antiochus would have been a ruler here. Ptolemy would have been here. This happened. And yet this was written before it happened. That's why people look at this and say, that can't be the case. That is too much detail. That is just too accurate. And yet the evidence shows that continually Daniel continues to build with everything and all these details. And I tell you again why I think God is doing this for Daniel and for us in just a moment. So these things happened. That actually took place. And so then what we go on to read is one from her family line will rise to take her place. That would have been her brother. This happened. He will attack the forces of the north. And so what ended up happening is so this Antiochus after... bumping buttons. Here we go. This Antiochus after Ptolemy died, basically he divorces the daughter. Okay? And so then he goes back to his previous wife, which was Laodice. And what ends up happening then is there's a plot at that point from the brother to kill Laodice, and he ends up poisoning Antiochus. It's just this back and forth conflict that keeps going on and on and on and on. Okay? So anyway, Some of those things, they're all historical. They're all documented in that sense. He will attack the forces and the king of the north and enter the fortress. He will fight against them and be victorious. He will also seize their gods, their metal images, and their valuable articles of silver and carry them off. Again, it's documented that they went in, they conquered the temple, and they brought back the stuff. It is just astounding. For some years, he will leave the king of the north alone. Then the king of the north will invade the realm of the king of the south. But he will retreat to his own country. His sons will prepare for war and assemble a great army, which will sweep on like an irresistible flood and carry the battle as far as his fortress. Then the king of the south will march out in rage against the king of the north. And this is, again, these are different people at different times kind of going through, but this battle rages on and on. Who will rise a large army, but it will be defeated. When the army is carried off, the king of the south, this is again Ptolemy and his offspring, the king of the south will be filled with pride and will slaughter many thousands. And it is said that when he went in, he killed, what was it? 10, 20,000 at one time, in one moment. Yet he will not remain triumphant, for the king of the north will muster another army larger than the first, and after several years he will advance with a huge army fully equipped. In those times, many will rise against the king of the south. The violent men among your own people, and these are Jews that actually, Hellenistic Jews, that kind of conformed with Greece and rose up and did fight against them. This, again, happened. And interestingly, some of these Hellenistic Jews are going to rise up and be seen as we get into this Antiochus Epiphanes here in just a moment. Then the king of the north, the violent man among your own people will rebel in fulfillment of the vision, but without success. Then the king of the north will come and build up siege ramps and will capture the fortified city. The forces of the south will be powerless to resist. Even their best troops will not have the strength to stand. The invader, here it is again, will do as he pleases. No one will be able to stand against him. He will establish himself in the beautiful land, that is Israel, and will have the power to destroy it. He will determine to come with the might of his entire kingdom and will make an alliance. Here's another alliance. This, again, is documented. This was with his daughter Cleopatra, not the Cleopatra of the movie. Different Cleopatra. Okay, this would have been Cleopatra the first. I think that would have been Cleopatra the... I don't remember. I tried. I think, never mind. He will determine to come to the might with his entire army and will make an alliance with the king of the south, and he will give him a daughter in marriage in order to overthrow the kingdom. But his plans will not succeed or help him. Then he will turn his attention to the coastlands and will take many of them. And this is this area here. At this point, then he ends up taking, this is for Greece, some of this landed right in there. Okay, again, documented. Then he will turn his attention to the coastlands and will make and take many of them, but a commander will put an end to his insolence and turn his insolence back upon him. After this, he will turn back towards the fortress of his own country and will stumble and fall to be seen no more. His successor, this is where it changes, his successor will send out a tax collector to maintain a royal splendor in the few years. However, he will be destroyed, yet not in anger or in battle. Again, that is true. And then we come to verse 21. And this is where we see that little horn rise up on the goat. So, that was a lot of history. I know I didn't give a ton of detail on that. But basically, we can point to all of these different events have different points of fulfillment. And I hope I haven't lost you in that. That's like a lot. Why would God give us all of that? That's like, it makes your head spin trying to read it, right? I know I've talked to some people that read this, like, I didn't make heads or tails out of it. Yep. But what we can find is, if we slow down, we just don't have time to hit all that. What we find is these marriages, these battles, we can identify in chronological order how they all took place, how they all happened, who was involved, and it is pretty remarkable and accurate. And then in verse 21, what we find is the abomination rises up again. So now, verses 21 through 35 are all about Antiochus Epiphanes, who we just spoke about a little bit ago. We've talked about him. You've heard about him. You've heard some of the terrible deeds that he had done. Now listen to what this again describes in regards to him and what we know about him. Keep in mind, this was all written before it took place. We look at it as our history, but to Daniel, it was prophecy. Okay? I know this is tough stuff. You're doing well. Hang with me. I don't see anyone sleeping yet. Okay? It says now, Antiochus, he will be succeeded by a contemptible person who is not given the honor of royalty. He will invade the kingdom when its people feel secure, and he will seize it through intrigue. Then an overwhelming army will be swept away before him. Both it and a prince of the covenant will be destroyed. After coming to an agreement with him, he will act deceitfully, and with only a few people, he will rise to power. Then the richest provinces feel secure. When the richest provinces feel secure, he will invade them and will achieve what neither his father, previous Antiochuses and Seleucids, nor his forefathers did. He will distribute plunder, loot, and wealth among his followers. He will plot and overthrow the fortresses, but only for a time. With a large army, he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south. This is exactly what he did. The king of the south will wage war with a large and very powerful army, but he will not be able to stand because of the plots devised against him. Those who eat from the king's provisions will try to destroy him. His armies will be swept away, and many will fall in battle. The two kings, with their hearts bent on evil, will sit at the same table and lie to each other, but to no avail. And this, again, is true, where they came and they created this basically, I don't know if you call it a ceasefire, but yet they deceived each other and they turned on each other. It's just remarkable, okay? The two kings, with their hearts bent on evil, will sit at the same table and lie to each other, but to no avail, because an end will still come at the appointed time. Even in the midst of all this, God is doing what he said he would do. The king of the north will return to his own country with great wealth, but his heart will be set against the holy covenant. So what ends up happening is Antiochus Epiphanes comes back in some capacity with his tail between his legs. And what ended up happening, he's so angry with the Jews because while he was gone, the Jews thought he was dead. And he comes back and they find out, oh, great Scott, he's not dead. And he takes out all of his anger from his loss in battle against the Jews, and he just begins to slaughter them and just oppress them and crush them, and over again. Anything he can do to take out against the Jews, he does that, including that stuff we talked about in the temple just a little bit ago. At the appointed time, he will invade the south again, but this time the outcome will be different from what it was before. Ships of the western coastlands will oppose him, and he will lose heart, then turn back and vent his fury against the holy covenant. He will return and show favor to those who forsake the holy covenant. Those are the Hellenistic Jews. There were some Jews that said, yep, Antiochus, we're with you, so that we can spare our own lives. We will do whatever it is that you want. And they turned away from the holy covenant, and they went with him. And that's exactly what happened. His armed forces will rise up, desecrate the temple fortress. Again, this happened. Will abolish the daily sacrifice. That's exactly what he did. Then they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. They set up Zeus in the Holy of Holies. And with flattery, he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant. But the people who know their God will firmly resist him. And this was the Judas Maccabeus who rallied against Antiochus and the rest and took back the temple and rededicated it to the Lord. Again, this is hundreds of years before it ever took place that Daniel was writing this stuff. Those who are wise will instruct many, though for a time they will fall by the sword or be burned or captured or plundered. When they fall, they will receive a little help, and many who are not sincere will join them. Some of the wise will stumble, so that they may be refined, purified, and made spotless until the time of the end. For it will come at the appointed time. And then what we see, and we're going to get into this next week, that's where it transitions again. So let me give it to you, hopefully in some simpler terms. That was a lot. And this is what I think and what God, I think, is doing. Timing is a big deal here. So when Daniel's writing this, he's writing this in basically five late, you know, or early, however you want to say that, but 539 is when Persia came in. Daniel didn't live past 500 BC. He was probably passed away or died roughly 520, give or take, in that ballpark area, okay? And so when Daniel dies, some things are going to happen. That's 500. So roughly 120 years from then, we enter into what is known as the silent period. And it's interesting, the silent period takes place basically in this 400 BC time until Jesus comes. So roughly 400 years. And this is coming in just before that silent period. And it gives it such astounding detail. I remember in college and even high school, but you have professors, you have teachers that get a test. The good teachers, you learn the material, you learn it well, and you go into your exam well prepared. Whether you've studied the stuff or not. And there's others. I remember going into the one who was a fabulous guy. I loved the man, but I had no idea how to study for his test. His name was Dr. Kramer. Okay. He used to use a chalkboard, and he would write so much on the chalkboard, he would disappear in this cloud of chalk dust. And his face, at the end of class, his face was white because he kept touching his face with white. And I'm not kidding. Okay. This is just how it was. He wrote so much on that board. Yeah. He gave us all the stuff, but it's like, honestly, when it came time to exam time, I had no idea if I had studied the right stuff. I'd leave the classroom going, I don't know if I got an A or if I totally failed it. I mean, it just was totally clueless. But then there were some other teachers. I loved him. He was good. But there was other teachers who you felt like they would give it to you. This is what you need. Let me be clear. This is exactly what you need. I remember I had one teacher in college. I think it was college trigonometry class. And he basically kind of laid out, this is what you need to know. You will need to know this and this and this and this and this. So if you study and you know these elements here, you will do fine in the final exam. And he taught it to us. We knew it. And so he was absolutely right. When it came to the final on the college trigonometry class, it was just like, I knew what it was that I needed to know. I'm pretty convinced that as I look at what we're seeing here in Daniel, I think God was giving the Jews everything that they needed to know to enter into these 400 years of the silent period. Does that make sense? I think that's why God gave so much detail. And it doesn't just stop with them, because I want us to grasp two elements this morning as we wrap up. One is, because God did it then, I think that God does do it now as well. And so the lessons that we learned, because God was faithful and did exactly what he said he would do for the Jews, we can also then be confident that God will do what he will do for us, okay? Does that make sense? He did it once. He's going to do it again. God will do what he says he's going to do. So I want us to be able to own that. I want us to be able to understand that and be able to internalize that capacity. But the other aspect is, and we haven't touched on it, but we're going to be getting onto it more next week, because what we find is now he transitions from what was our past, Daniel's future, and next week we're going to start hitting into what is our future. You see that? So there's this progression. And so right here now in verse 36, he transitions into another person. Another Antichrist, another Antiochus-type person who is going to come that we can know and look for, and so we can have a confidence that God is in the works and is going to do exactly what he said he's going to do. And that gets into some of the end time stuff. It'll be interesting then next week as well. Do you follow that? So here's where we're at. That's what I want to meet with then today. We've got all of this stuff. God has given us what it is that we need to be able to move forward in our relationship with him. Does that make sense? He gave Daniel and the Jews what it was that they needed. He knew that in entering these 400 years of silence, they would need this to be able to make it through, to be able to identify who that Messiah was. And they could look at these events, if they chose to, and open up the book of Daniel, they could look at it and say, okay, I see what God's doing. He's doing exactly what he said he was going to do. I'm with it. He's given me what I need. I believe he's given us what we need. Even when God seems silent and our prayers seem to go unanswered, I think we have what we need to know that he's going to do what he's going to do. Are we okay? That was a lot of history. Okay? Next week it's going to transition a little bit. I hope I didn't lose you too much. Next week it's going to transition a little bit. And we're going to start looking at not the history part, but wow, what does God have for us now laid out that we can look for in the future? Is that heavy?
Right, I'm sorry. You got to have that once in a while, right? Okay, because then it makes the lighter ones feel that much better. Okay, I'm going to invite Lane and the worship team to come up and close us off here this morning. And as we do, I do want you to understand and know we have the Word of God. We have what it is that we need to be able to take us from even these times where we feel like, where is God? Why is he silent? To move us into, okay, I can trust him here. I can trust him here.